You've only got to mention the name of Elijah for a blank look to come over the face of your conversationalist, especially if you should happen to mention Elisha in the same breath, because they haven't the foggiest notion about the difference between the two men. I don't know if you know the story of the theological student who was taking his final examinations and was flummoxed by being invited to write an essay on the differences between Elijah and Elisha in a comparative study. Well, he hadn't done much work, if the truth be told, particularly in the Old Testament. He certainly didn't know the difference between those two fellows, and all he'd really done in the Old Testament was to learn a list of the kings of Israel and Judah. So this is how he began his reply. "Let us not haggle over the qualities of these two truly great men. Let us rather give a list of the kings of Israel and Judah in their chronological order." Well, we are very much hoping that in the course of the next five Sundays, during this sermon series, our understandings about Elijah particularly will greatly increase and clarify. Elijah was one of the great men of the Old Testament. Elijah was to the prophets what Moses was to the law. Moses and Elijah were, as it were, the representatives of the law and the prophets, which is no doubt the reason why they both appeared together on the Mount of Transfiguration and spoke with Jesus about his exodus, about his coming death for our sins. Now, this series has been entitled A Crisis of Confidence. And the reason is that Elijah lived in the 9th century BC, in which there was a fundamental clash or confrontation between Yahweh, the living and true God, the God of Israel on the one hand, and Baal, the false fertility god of Canaan and Phoenicia on the other. And in each of these studies, as in each of the chapters of 1 Kings that tell the story of Elijah, some aspect of this confrontation or collision between Yahweh and Baal will emerge. Now, I thought it was necessary, and I hope you'll forgive me if you don't think it is necessary, I thought it was necessary to fill in for you just a little bit of the historical background. I'm sure you know that King Solomon was the third and last of the kings of the United Monarchy. Saul was the first, David the second, and Solomon the third. And that after the death of Solomon, the monarchy was split in two, so that the northern kingdom under Jeroboam came to be called Israel, with its capital Samaria, while the southern kingdom under King Rehoboam came to be known as Judah, with its capital Jerusalem. Well, Elijah lived during the reign of King Ahab in the northern kingdom of Israel. So why don't I ask you now to open your Bible, and I wonder if you turn to page 316 of the Old Testament, and we really need to start not with chapter 17, but the end of chapter 16. And we'll go through this quite quickly. 1 Kings 16, verse 29, we find Ahab ascending to the throne of Israel. Verse 30, "Ahab did more evil in the sight of the Lord than all the kings who had preceded him." Verse 31, "He not only followed the bad example of Jeroboam, the first king of Israel, but he married Jezebel, who was a Sidonian princess." And the results of this mismatch, not only because she was a foreigner, but because she was a pagan, were catastrophic. end of verse 31, Ahab served and worshipped Baal. Here, almost certainly identical with Melkart, the god of the Sidonians, whom she, Jezebel, had introduced into Israel. Verse 32, Ahab proceeded then to build a temple to Baal in Samaria and to erect an altar to Baal in the temple. Beginning of verse 33, Ahab went on to make an Asherah, which was almost certainly a wooden figurine, a little tiny idol or wooden figurine of Ashtaroth, who was Baal's female consort. So that Baal was the god and Ashtaroth the goddess. End of verse 33, Ahab did more to provoke Yahweh to anger by his idolatry than all the kings who had preceded him. Verse 34 seems to refer to the horrors of child sacrifice, because Ahab probably encouraged it. And then in the following chapters, and I mustn't trespass into the territory which will be covered by my colleagues in the following Sundays, but I will just mention in chapter 18, we read how Jezebel killed the prophets of Yahweh and extended her patronage instead to 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Ashtaroth. And then in the following chapter, Elijah complains that all the people have rejected God's covenant, smashed his altars, and killed his prophets. So that was the situation. Has that confused you even more? Let me bring this confrontation into clearer focus. On the one hand, there were King Ahab and Queen Jezebel, who had repudiated the religion of Yahweh and had established in its place as the state religion the religion of Baal and Ashtaroth. On the other hand, there was Elijah, man of God, determined, as God gave him grace, to stand firm for the truth and not to compromise it one iota. That's the confrontation between church and state, between prophet and king, between Yahweh and Baal. And the question arises, what was fundamentally at stake in that confrontation? Who was Yahweh or Jehovah who was unwilling to share power with Baal? I don't know if you know that what the word Elijah means, his name. Elijah means Yahweh is God, because the El part is God and the Elijah, the Jah part, is Yahweh. So Yahweh is God. And this was Elijah's great stand, which he refused in any way to compromise. Well, I found it very impressive in meditating on 1 Kings 17 during this week to see what a comprehensive understanding of the nature of God had been given to Elijah. I've got three or four points to make, and I hope I shall carry you with me. First, Yahweh was and is the God both of church and of state. There was no difference between church and state in Elijah's conviction about the sovereignty of God. God was sovereign over both the so-called secular and sacred areas of life. You see, Ahab and Jezebel were quite prepared to tolerate Elijah's existence so long as he stayed in the church. But they weren't prepared for Yahweh's followers to interfere in politics. Does that strike a familiar note at the end of the 20th century? Elijah had a quite different idea of his responsibilities and the responsibilities of the church, the people of God, quite different from Ahab and Jezebel. You look on, if you will, to verse 1 of chapter 17, where Elijah stood before Ahab and confronted the king in person. He announced that there was going to be a period of drought in judgment upon the apostate nation. And Elijah confronted Ahab again in a chapter or two later on a human rights issue with regard to Naboth's vineyard. You may remember the story. Well, if that is the church meddling in politics, then Elijah was splendidly meddlesome. He refused to stay in the church because the church is intended to be the conscience of the nation and of the state. So church and state, according to Scripture, have reciprocal responsibilities. It is the duty of the state to protect the church and to safeguard its freedom to worship and to teach. But it is the responsibility of the church to witness to the state and be its conscience. So when the church speaks out on a subject of truth or righteousness, it is not interfering in politics. It is doing what God called it to do. And Elijah saw that clearly. Yahweh is the God of church and state, and both together. Now, secondly, Yahweh is the God of both nature and history. Now, Baal, the false god of Canaan and Phoenicia, Baal was a fertility god, and Ashtaroth was a fertility goddess. Now that means that the seasons of the year and the changes of the weather and the productivity of the soil and the mysteries of human procreation and life were all regarded as under the control of Baal and Ashtaroth. They were responsible for fertility, whether in the human species or in nature and the harvest. But you will understand that this ascription of the processes of nature to Baal was exceedingly offensive to the followers of Yahweh. Just incidentally, as the ascription of these processes to science, in inverted commas and with a capital S, without any reference to God, is offensive to the people of God today. You cannot ascribe nature to science any more than you could ascribe it to Baal and Ashtaroth. It's the same kind of idolatry today as was being practiced then. Because Yahweh, the living and the true God, is the God of nature, the creator of the universe and the sustainer of the universe that he has brought into being. And the sun and the rain and the weather and the harvest and procreation and life are in the hand of Yahweh, and they are in nobody else's hand. So surely it is not an accident in 1 Kings 17 that there is a great deal of reference to nature. We're told in verse 1 that there will be no dew or rain for a number of years. And God was able to say that because he's in charge of the rain and the dew. He is the God of nature and not Baal. It's not an accident that God commands the ravens to feed Elijah, because God has a partiality to ravens, having created them himself. And I have a little more to tell you about ravens in a few minutes. And then God multiplied the flour and the oil in the household of the widow of Zarephath, and he restored to life her dead son. Because again, rain and dew and ravens and flour and oil and life are all in the hand of God. They are his gift, and he is in control. So Yahweh is the God of nature, but he's also the God of history. He's concerned about the political process. He's concerned about the relations between different nations and countries, about the life of the community, about social justice. And these are the very areas which Ahab and Jezebel regarded as being under their jurisdiction and didn't want any interference from Yahweh Thank you very much. So Yahweh is the God of church and state, and Yahweh is the God of nature and history, and thirdly, Yahweh is the God of both Israel and the nations. Now, we need to think carefully about this. You see, the gods of the heathen, of the heathen countries that were surrounding Israel and Judah, were local deities and tribal deities. And they were thought by their adherents to preside over the destiny and over the territory of their own particular people. But they were regarded as having no jurisdiction in other territories and no right to trespass into the countries that were around them. No, they had a local jurisdiction, and they were tribal deities. So Chemosh was the god of the Moabites, and Milcom was the god of the Ammonites, and Melkart was the god of the Sidonians, and Dagon was the god of the Philistines, and Marduk was the god of the Babylonians, and Baal was the god of the Canaanites. And each of them was a little local tribal deity. But Yahweh was the God of the whole world. It is true that three times in our passage he's called the God of Israel. But the reason why he's called the God of Israel is not because his jurisdiction is limited to Israel, but because he chose Israel out of all the nations of the earth to be his own people with whom he entered into a particular covenant. But the God of Israel is the God of the whole world. So that means that he was no tribal deity. He was the God of the nations and the God of the spirits of all flesh. So the territories claimed by these pagan deities, by Marduk and Melkart and Dagon and all the rest, were territories that actually belonged to Yahweh, the true and the living and the only God. And Jezebel's attempt to extend the territory of Baal into the territory of Israel was an act of extreme arrogance. Now, this truth is very clear in the chapter that we have opened before us. Do you remember how Yahweh sent Elijah during the time of drought across the river Jordan, outside the promised land, into a foreign territory in order to hide by the brook Kerith or Cherith, where Yahweh promised to look after him and to sustain his life, outside the promised land? And then a little later, Yahweh sent Elijah to Zarephath, which is situated on the Phoenician coast between Tyre and Sidon, which was not only outside the promised land, but inside the territory of Jezebel. She was a Zidonian. She worshipped Baal and Ashtaroth, the god and goddess of Sidon. But it was there that Yahweh sent Elijah, promising to look after him in that foreign territory. Yahweh's jurisdiction is not limited to Israel. Yahweh's jurisdiction extends over all the nations of the world. I wonder if you remember that Jesus emphasized this very point when he referred to 1 Kings 17. It was in the synagogue at Nazareth when he was beginning his public ministry that he read from Isaiah, and afterwards he commented on it about the Messiah's jurisdiction over the nations. He said there were many widows in Israel in the time of Elijah, but Elijah was not sent to any widow in Israel. He was only sent to the widow of Zarephath, who was a Gentile in a Gentile country. But Yahweh is the God of the nations as well as the God of Israel. Then fourthly, Yahweh is the God of both providence and miracle. I think it's very important for us to see what the chapter has to teach us on this subject. We must learn to distinguish between providence and miracle. We tend to say much too readily, oh, it's a miracle, when actually it's nothing of the kind, it's a providence. And we must distinguish between the two and have both words in our vocabulary. Now, both providence and miracle are activities of God. But providence is God working through natural processes, while miracle is God's deviation from the natural order and is a supernatural event. And both providences and miracles are recorded in 1 Kings 17. Thus, at the brook Cherith, Yahweh acted in providence in caring for Elijah. After all, the water was already there in the wadi. God didn't create it supernaturally. It wasn't a miracle. The water was there until it dried up, and all Elijah had to do was to drink from it. And as for the ravens, I promised to tell you a bit more about them. Well, they are scavengers by nature. So there's nothing very miraculous about ravens dropping food near enough for Elijah to pick it up and consume it himself. The ravens were there. They were acting according to their nature when God used them to bring food to his prophet. So at Cherith, God was acting providentially. But in Zarephath, he acted miraculously. For both the multiplication of oil and flour and the restoration of life to the widow's dead son were miracles. At least I hope you'll accept that they were miracles, and we are not intended to understand that the reason why the flour and the oil lasted was that the widow persuaded her neighbors to share theirs with her. And we're not foolish enough to imagine that the boy only fainted, and so he revived again after his fainting fit. No, both the multiplication of the flour and the oil and the restoration of the boy's life were miraculous. So God was acting in 1 Kings 17 in both ways. Now, in our day, when there is a great deal of emphasis, over-emphasis, as I believe, on miracles, on signs and wonders, so-called, it would be important for us to learn from Elijah two mistakes to avoid. First, we must avoid the mistake of regarding Elijah as typical of ordinary Christian people today, so that anything that Elijah did, we can do, and do it maybe even better. It is a mistake to imagine that we can put ourselves into the shoes of all Old Testament characters and imitate them precisely. No, we have to recognize, we have to know enough about our Bible to recognize that Abraham and Moses and Elijah and the prophets and Jesus and the apostles all had a unique role to play in the development of salvation history, and that they were not typical of us ordinary Christian men and women today. Now, it's quite true that James in his letter describes Elijah as a man like us and encourages us to expect that God will answer our prayers as he answered the prayers of Elijah. That's right. But to imitate Elijah's prayers is not the same thing as to imitate Elijah's miracles. Frankly, the Bible gives us no warrant for believing that we can multiply flour and oil miraculously any more than we can multiply loaves and fishes miraculously as Jesus did. The Bible gives us no warrant to believe that we can raise the dead or that we can call fire down from heaven. Nor does it give us any expectation that when the time comes, a chariot of fire will arrive to transport us to heaven, which is what happened to Elijah without his needing to die. No, there were special events in the life of a prophet of God. Elijah had a special role to fulfill as a prophet, and his miracles authenticated his ministry as a prophet. So the last verse in our chapter is rather important. When after he performed these miracles, the widow said, verse 24, "Now I know that you are a man of God," which doesn't just mean a godly man. It's a phrase that is reserved, actually, in the Old Testament for Elijah and Moses and Daniel and one or two other prophets. "Now I know that you are a special man of God and a prophet, and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is true." So Elijah's miracles authenticated the truth of his message and of his ministry. But now there is a second mistake that we need to avoid. And that is the mistake that regards miracles as either the only way in which God works in the world today or the main way in which he works. Because much more often, God works through providence than through miracle. Let me put it like this. In our chapter, to me it's very fascinating, in 1 Kings 17, that the same God who multiplied the oil and the flour miraculously gave Elijah water at the brook Cherith providentially. Or again, the same God who raised the boy miraculously from death sent ravens to feed Elijah providentially. And the overemphasis on miracles today is in danger of turning God into a magician. And it gives the impression that miracles are his main or usual mode of activity. But when you fall into that mistake, then you don't see the living God as Jesus portrayed him, as the one who causes the sun to rise and who sends rain on the just and on the unjust and who feeds the birds of the air and who clothes the lilies of the field. In other words, a God who is working providentially through the processes of nature which he has established. Well, it's time to draw this to a conclusion. Let me just recapitulate what we've tried to see so far. Behind the confrontation between Elijah and Ahab, there lay a confrontation between Yahweh and Baal. At stake was the kind of God Yahweh is. Elijah was later to say, "I have been very jealous for the Lord of hosts, very jealous for his honor." Because Elijah couldn't bear to see Yahweh compared with tribal godlings of the heathen nations. Yahweh is supreme. He is the one and only God, and his jurisdiction is universal. It is over church and state, over nature and history, over Israel and the nations, and over providence and miracles. And in comparison with him, the heathen gods around were just non-entities. They didn't exist. That's what we've tried to see so far. So in conclusion, I want to say thank God for Elijah. I thank God that Elijah lived such a God-centered life. I'm very grateful that he was true to his own name, Elijah. Yahweh is God, and there is no other. I thank God that Elijah boldly confronted King Ahab. Verse 1, "In the name of the God who lives and in whose presence I stand," said Elijah. He was very conscious of the reality of God. And I thank God that Elijah was outraged by the arrogant pretensions of Baal and Ashtoreth. He was jealous for the name and honor of the living and true God. Now, today, the confrontation is different. We do not confront Baal and Ashtoreth and Melkart and Marduk and Dagon and these other tribal deities. They've long ago been forgotten for the non-entities they were and are. Our confrontation is not with them. It is with the false gods of secularism, materialism, and the appalling self-centeredness of the New Age movement. We cannot come to terms with any of these idolatries, and that is what they are. For an idol is simply a god substitute. An idolatry is a rival of the true and the living God. We need today young men and women who are here particularly, who are at the threshold of their career, need today the no-compromise spirit of Elijah. We need to be jealous for the honor and glory of God. And we need to refuse to demote Yahweh to the status of one God among many. There is only one living and true God. Yahweh is God. And may Elijah's name become our battle cry. He is the Lord. He is sovereign. And his sovereignty extends over every sphere. He says, I am God. There is no other, and I will not share my glory with idols. May God give us the spirit and power of Elijah in standing without compromise for him.